Death Valley, from the February 1967 edition of Leatherneck Magazine. Written by Master Sergeant Herb Freeman. Read by Nick Wilson. Introduction. The 26th Marines, a regiment of the 5th Marine Division, was deactivated shortly after the end of World War II and reformed in April 1966 at Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton, California. At that time, the 5th Marine Division had not been reformed, and when 126 was sent to Vietnam, it was placed under the administrative and operational control of the 1st Marine Division. Peter F. Long, the Sergeant Major of 126, said, "We began the damnedest training schedule you ever saw. We were in the field 120 hours a week, preparing for assignment to Vietnam. The regiment sailed from San Diego on July 9th and conducted a training exercise in the Philippine Islands while en route to Vietnam. On August 16th, 4.5 months after activation, the regiment made a tactical landing on Vietnamese soil as part of Operation Deckhouse 3. After 4 days of fighting, they were backloaded, and 33 days later, they made their second landing, Phase 2 of Deckhouse 3. On August 30th, the battalion boarded ship again and sailed for Subic Bay in the Philippines. They departed 12 days later and landed in Quang Tri Province on September 14th. Within 4 hours after landing, they had made contact with the enemy and for the next 10 days battled regular North Vietnamese Army forces. They were reassigned to the Da Nang area during the latter part of September to participate in Operation Macon, their fourth operation within 40 days. After Macon came the Battle of Death Valley. A squad from Company C was in position. They had slipped, they hoped unnoticed, into a position 500 yards southwest of Cam Van, shortly before dawn. They now lay hiding in dense foliage, waiting for dawn and elements of Company D. They were planning a surprise for Charlie. As the first streaks of dawn began to light the sky, two Company D squads stood ready to move out from their command post on a hill that overlooked Death Valley and the hamlet of Cam Van. Every day, Company D troops accompanied engineers on a road sweep detail to clear Liberty Road of mines. The road passed within 50 yards of the command post, ran down a hill, across the river, and through Death Valley. It also ran within 700 or 800 yards of Cam Van. Today, road sweep missions would be the same, with one exception. When the detail reached a point several hundred yards out from the village, part of the detail would break off and move to link up with Company C squad. A Viet Cong turncoat had informed 126 that 15 VC were in Cam Van. If they were still there, the patrol was to flush them out of hiding and meet them head-on or push them toward the river, which separated the hill and Company D's CP from Death Valley. Two tanks were in position to take care of Charlie if he tried to make his escape across the river. A lot of sniper fire had been received from Cam Van. The source of information seemed good, and Captain Richard J. Widener, Company D commander, wanted a piece of this action. The captain, as well as every other member of the battalion, had been trying for weeks to make direct contact with Charlie. "Okay, let's move out," commanded 1st Lieutenant Clarence O. Reynolds, a Company D platoon commander. When the patrol reached the bottom of the hill, it was not yet full light, but already Navy Seabees were at work. They were constructing a permanent bridge across the river. A pontoon bridge was making do for the present. Nearby stood a tank. It was there to discourage the VC from sniping at the Seabees, a favorite pastime of Charlie. A squad of Marines was also deployed in the area, part of the CP security guard. They also provided protection to the Seabees. If Charlie wanted a Seabee, it would be a dangerous adventure. The tank was one of the two which would take care of any VC flush from the village. The other tank was on a hill, just 10 yards below Company CP. It commanded overall view of the river and village from this position. "All right, keep it spread out," yelled the lieutenant as the men crossed the pontoon bridge and entered Death Valley. From this point on, anything could happen. To lose one man to an undetected mine or sniper fire was one thing, but to lose several because they were too close together was something else. The lieutenant was making sure the men kept their proper interval. "We'll break off up there," a lieutenant said as he indicated a spot with a point of his finger. "Looks good to me," replied the captain. "I'll bring up the rear." The rear of the column was an unhealthy spot. Snipers liked to let the lead elements pass and then hit the rear of the column. It was the lieutenant's patrol and his job to lead to the link-up position. With the lieutenant leading the column, the captain knew he would be more value in position near the rear if anything began to pop up. At the designated spot, First Lieutenant Reynolds turned to his right and headed across a rice paddy toward a tree line and its protection. Silently, the men accompanying the lieutenant followed. All was quiet as they disappeared into the brush, and the road sweep detail continued on. The road sweepers hadn't gone far when rifle shots broke the early morning calm. Charlie had been heard from, loud and clear. Men on the far side of the road scrambled into a ditch, which afforded protection and a good firing position. With a calmness that comes from experience, Lance Corporal Earl E. Ramsey, who was on the near side of the road, dropped into a kneeling position. After scanning the distant tree line for a second, he let go with a burst of automatic fire from his M14. Others followed suit, firing at likely sniper positions. "You never see the sniper," said the young Lance Corporal. "You pick a likely spot where he might be hiding and let go. If you return fire, they make it disappear. But if you don't, they'll stick around and keep pinging at you," he explained. Ramsey was speaking from experience, since he had run into Charlie before. He was wearing a bandage on his right hand, which proved it. "I was on a patrol a couple of days ago and got dinged in the hand by shrapnel. We had stopped to eat when it happened. All of us saw them, but from a distance. It looked like two kids. I still don't know if they were kids or not. Anyhow, I saw them coming down the path towards us, but didn't think too much about it. You always run across lots of kids when you're on patrol. Luckily, one of the guys was keeping a closer eye on them than the rest. He saw them draw back to throw the grenades and shouted a warning for us to hit the deck. If he hadn't yelled, we could have all hung it up. I got a small piece of shrapnel in the hand, and that was all. One man gave chase to the kids, but he didn't go far. It's not healthy to be running around out here alone." Ramsey was right. The sniper must have made it as soon as the Marines began returning fire, because all had been quiet for several minutes. Satisfied the sniper was gone, the squad leader got the men moving again. The road sweep detail finished their mission without further incident and arrived back at the CP ahead of the squad searching the village. From the CP, you could see the village below, nestled in a grove of trees and surrounded by rice paddies. The Marines, fanned out over a wide front, were visible through binoculars, and the tank crew watched the action below. Smoke could be seen rising from the underbrush as the patrol passed VC tunnel hideouts with grenades. Where was Charlie? The tankers waited, watched and listened on the radio, hoping word would come that the VC had been routed and were heading towards the river. But today, their patient vigil was for naught. "It wasn't a very eventful patrol," the captain disappointedly related after returning to his CP. "The villagers reported about 15 VC had been in the area, but they had left the night before. We destroyed several tunnels and huts the VC had been using for shelter and found an 81mm mortar round, automatic weapon, and a sniper scope. We also picked up 4 suspected VC. I guess this wasn't too bad for morning work," the captain added as an afterthought. "I wasn't too surprised that we didn't find any VC in the village. They never stay in one place for very long. In their line of work, you can't afford to set up housekeeping. They stay on the move and seem to avoid any areas where there are Marines. These villages are swarming with kids, and this is one of Charlie's main sources of information. They'll send one man ahead to find out if the children have seen any Marines in the area. If the kids say yes, then you can bet the VC will stay out of the village until the Marines are out of the area. The villagers are cooperative with us, but they are with the VC also, and I don't blame them. They just don't want to get hurt. I'd probably do the same if I were in their position. This makes it tough to try and catch the VC by surprise, though. But we try." The morning search of Kam Van was a special mission, and the normal routine of patrolling Death Valley had to continue. Every day, from sun up to sundown, a platoon from each company sent roving patrols combing the area for Charlie. It was one of Company C's roving patrol squads that had made the village sweep with elements of Company D. The Company C squad had left the patrol base from which they had been operating for the past 4 days. At 4:30 a.m. It was now noon. The squad had taken a few minutes to get some hot chow at the Company D command post, which, after 4 days of living in the field and eating cold rations, was a welcome break. They had already been on the go for almost 8 hours, and it would have been nice to linger in the relative comfort of the CP, but they were due back at the patrol base. As soon as they returned, another squad would move out. It was raining, like it can only rain during the tropical monsoon season, and there had been a downpour for several days. 14 inches of rain had fallen in one 24-hour period. What had been only a few days before ankle-deep water was now waist-deep and spots chest-deep. Most of the route back to the patrol base would be through rain-swollen rice paddies, at their sticky, oozing mud. Each time you raised a foot, taking another step, the other sank in the mud. Walking through paddies would make 2 miles seem like 10, but this was better than following the paths that could be mined or laced with booby traps. It would be a grueling 2 miles back to the patrol base hideout, which was the dilapidated remnant of what had once been a thatched hut. There wasn't much left of the hut, but a roof with the gaping holes, which the Marines had covered with palm leaves. Even Tarzan would have considered it a ridiculous excuse for shelter. However, its location made a good spot for the PB, and it was better than nothing at all. Even though the dirt floor was a mud puddle, the roof, or what was left of it, did offer some welcome protection against the incessant rain. This was their destination. The squad moved out, headed down the hill across the bridge and back into Death Valley. Leading the squad, which was now formed into two widely separated staggered columns, was First Lieutenant Eric M. Barnes. As they broke through thickets and started across the paddies, the lieutenant urged the men to move faster. You don't dally when you're moving across open terrain of a paddy. On they went through village, two or three huts grouped together, paddy and thicket. Watch that tree line and brush on the right. Did all those people have proper identification? Check out that tunnel. The lieutenant wasn't missing any bets, but the trek back to the PB was made without incident. As soon as he dried his hands, the lieutenant began marking on a map the route and checkpoints for the next patrol. We never follow the same route twice, he explained. And each patrol contacts the PB by radio at the designated checkpoints. He handed the map to the sergeant, who was to lead the next patrol. He gave them a few seconds to study the map, then asked, "Got it?" "Got it," replied the sergeant. "I'll see you back at the CP, Lieutenant." The platoon's 4 days on roving patrol were coming to an end, and they were returning to the company command post. Tonight they would have at least a tent over their heads. Better yet, it meant a dry pair of socks and some clean, dry utilities. Even if they only stayed for a couple of hours, which was about all they could hope for, it was something they hadn't known for 4 days. Another platoon would take over the roving patrol duties, and Lieutenant Barnes's 3rd Platoon would become the CP security guard. For the next 4 days, they would spend sleepless nights in sandbag reinforced foxhole bunkers which surrounded the CP. 4 days of road sweep details, special security watches for CBs working on Liberty Road, and supply runs would follow. After that, it would be back to the paddies on roving patrol. Liberty Road was constructed as a main supply route from Da Nang to An Hoa, and 6 or 7 miles of the road went through the center of 126's area. The battalion command post sat on a hill at the northern end of the area, which companies D, C, B, and A spread along the road to the south. Protecting the road from snipers was a main objective of the battalion. Since moving into the area, every company of 126 had suffered losses. Several times daily, rounds were even lobbed into the battalion CP. Vehicles that had to travel Liberty Road were often the sniper's target. For obvious reasons, someone nicknamed the tropical green rice belt south of the battalion CP Death Valley, and it stuck. No one could argue with the logic of the name, least of all Company C. They had been hit the hardest in Death Valley. I've lost as many men here as I did at the DMZ when we were fighting North Vietnamese regular army forces, said Company C's commander, Captain Charles W. Kappelman. It was late afternoon, but the captain's day was far from over. It would be at least another 7 hours before he could quit for the day. There were supply requisitions to go over, a conference with his platoon leaders, personnel reports, messages to the S3, plus a dozen other responsibilities. The captain was heating water on a pocket-sized one-burner gas stove, a gift from his wife, to make a cup of instant coffee as he waited for the last two patrols of the day to report back. "It's frustrating! Seldom, if ever, do you even see a guy that's shooting at you," he said. "It's a tough kind of war to fight." Thinking back, he told of a day when we almost took 8 or 9 Charlie, usually work in groups of 2 or 3, by surprise. We made a wide sweeping movement around the area where one of our patrols had been hit real hard. We were pretty sure the VC were still there, and we had circled around to come in from the rear. It almost worked! We even got close enough to hear their warning signal, which sounded like someone beating 2 hollow pieces of bamboo together. We got close, but the signal warned them in time to make an escape across the river. The captain's conversation was interrupted by several bursts of rifle fire in the distance. "Where are our patrols now?" barked the captain. After several seconds, a young Marine who was operating with the CP's radio answered, "They're both near Checkpoint 3, sir." A quick look at the map told the captain the position of his patrols. He knew they would call in if they had run into Charlie, unless maybe the radio operator had been hit and his radio knocked out. The captain lauded the VC on their patience when he told of how they would wait, and wait, and wait to pick a time and place to strike. A time and place that would be to their advantage. But the captain wasn't one for waiting. A full minute, or maybe even two, had elapsed since he heard the rifle fire. "Find out if those were our people," he ordered. "No, sir," came the reply. "It was Delta Company doing the firing." The captain relaxed. "We return their fire," he continued, "and when we can, we hit their area with mortars. We're hurting them. I know we are. But you just never get to see the results. They never leave their dead or wounded around to be found." It was almost dark now, and the last two patrols had reported in. The squad leaders, Sergeant Arthur L. Gaines and Corporal William F. Bartkus, both of whom had been wounded during fighting at the DMZ, had the same to report. "No contact." For Gaines, this had been about his 40th patrol. He had lost count in the Death Valley. Bartkus had only been returned to duty 10 days before this, and this was his 8th. Both patrols had been basically the same. During the morning, snipers had fired at Gaines' patrol, but not the afternoon. Routine was the way each described the afternoon outing. Yep. The fact it had been a rather quiet afternoon attested to the fact that Charlie was being hurt. Snipers used to ping at C Company patrols, as well as those of the other companies, as many as 10 times a day. Now the average was down to once or twice. Charlie still found the vehicles on Liberty Road too great a temptation to pass up, but was sniping from a greater distance and not as often. It may be a frustrating kind of war for 126, but they may not get to see the VC they had accounted for, but the results of their efforts are becoming more apparent every day.